Ms. Blue against International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, number 11-1484. And we'll hear from Mr. Arellano.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Victor Arellano. I represent the IBEW Local 159 in this case. There are three issues before this court, one of which I believe has been already decided, and that is the jurisdiction over the current motion that is before the court.
Why do you think that's already decided?
We received an order from the court indicating such position.
No, I think the court sometimes takes the – well, first of all, jurisdiction isn't over till it's over. But I believe that this issue was simply taken with the case.
And
we
that.
Requested briefing. And I'll tell you that in light of the way Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 6B operates vis-a-vis Rule 50 and 59 – and the dependency of Appellate Rule 4 on 28 U.S.C. Section 2107, I think there is a very significant jurisdictional issue here. So I would be interested in your thoughts.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor.
Are you ready for that?
I should be ready. Thank you. Well, certainly there is an issue of waiver in this case. The union takes the position that the plaintiff has waived the objection. In fact,
you can't waive a jurisdictional objection.
I refer to the National Ecological Foundation decision, a decision where the waiver was applied to a very similar situation.
No. The Supreme Court has held that the time requirements of 4A are mandatory and jurisdictional. They can't be.
And certainly that is something that obviously may have to be, at the end, decided by this particular court.
Before you jump into this case you're relying on, first of all, as Judge Rovner says, the Supreme Court has said that the time requirements of Rule 4A on the civil side are mandatory and jurisdictional because they have a base in the statute, I cited, 28 U.S.C. Section 2107. That statute and the rule have a specific provision for extending the length of time to appeal. It's in the statute. It's subpart C. It's in the rule where you can go to the district court within the 30 days or the 30 days after and ask for more time. But that, of course, didn't happen here. So it seems to me it would undermine the statutory scheme to regard the time limits for a Rule 50-59 motion as mere claims processing rules instead of really rules that are embedded in this whole statutory structure.
It is the position of the union that there was a motion to get an extension of time, and the court granted that motion.
It's not within its power to do, and the judge recognizes that eventually.
And the lower court still continue to take the position that since the plaintiff had not objected to that, understanding the position that the court has taken, this became a case of a waiver in so many words.
Well, but let me outline for you what I think might have happened. If you look at Rule 4, we have too many subsections in today's world, 4A, 4, capital A, and then there's some subparts under that. If you go all the way down to subpart 6, you see that a motion filed after 28 days is really a motion under Rule 60. And so your appeal would be timely as to the denial of those kinds of post-28-day motions, but it's not timely vis-a-vis the underlying judgment that you would really like to get at. And again, that's a way that the rule says, well, the district judge thought he could extend the time for a Rule 50-59 motion. He extends it to September 10th. He's wrong. He didn't have time to do that. It doesn't mean the motion disappears from the face of the earth. What it does mean, though, is that it, in effect, it turns into a Rule 60 motion, and our review is limited to that. I mean, I think that that is spelled out, actually, in quite a few opinions of this court. We do sometimes limit the appeal when somebody is late.
And I believe that's the only item that we're addressing.
So that's your theory? You agree that that's the analysis you want us to adopt?
That's correct.
You had the right to appeal the order, not the underlying judgment.
That is true.
That you met those time requirements.
That is true.
Right. And I don't think there's any question about that. I think you met those time requirements.
Yeah.
At that point, you're facing a tough standard of review. You're facing an abuse of discretion standard of review.
Why don't you go on to the merits?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, this is a case where basically it's a Title VII case in a 1981 action where the plaintiff basically, it is our position that the plaintiff had a history of problems. Very divisive individual, very difficult individual.
But the jury didn't buy that. I mean, you presented evidence that the jury might have credited to that effect, there was other evidence in the record that she'd had an unblemished record until Mr. Harrelson became the business manager, and it wasn't until she took up the cause of Mr. Phillips that she suddenly started being barraged with these problems.
There was testimony from us, from acting supervisors, that she had been verbally disciplined. She had been admonished.
But there was the problem is the jury heard all that and they didn't find the witnesses credible, or they wouldn't have found for her. So it's very difficult. That's a steep hurdle for you to overcome.
It is.
Because you got all your evidence out, right? It wasn't like there was evidence you didn't get to present.
That's true. Which leads me to the next item. The next item is that we contend that the lower court made an error when the MEOC file was admitted into evidence.
But didn't most of what Phillips, most of the allegations come out during the testimony of the witnesses at trial? I mean, basically all that testimony came
except
out.
Except for the probable cause decision. The probable cause decision was sent to the jury. It was an extremely negative decision that should not have been admitted. We have two cases that I can relate to, and one is the Manuel versus Chicago, City of Chicago, as well as the Lewis versus City of Chicago, where the courts were confronted with an identical problem, whether or not Federal Rule of Evidence 403 should have precluded this type of extremely damaging evidence. For example, in this
case... That's where Judge Williams' point is important. 403 is a balancing process.
That's true.
And there's normally a lot of discretion because the district court is the one on the scene. And if the evidence is in the general range, of the jury had to know that what Ms. Blue was doing was not just wasting everybody's time. Mr. Phillips had a serious case, and she was advocating it.
And that's precisely my point. There was sufficient testimony from the plaintiff. There were comments by counsel during the opening and closing. There was plenty of evidence for the jury to make a determination based on what was presented. But it is our contention that once the MEOC probable cause decision went into the jury, that became a very difficult burden for the defendants to overcome.
That wasn't even the direct issue that you were facing. You were trying to say Ms. Blue was a troublesome employee and all of these other things, and she's saying, no, you retaliated against me. And so this is kind of secondary level evidence.
It is, but it's extremely connected, Your Honor, because this was a case that I believe that once the jury got this information about what had happened to Mr. Phillips, and not necessarily about what happened to Ms. Blue, this was a highly prejudicial decision by the court.
But the court, didn't the court offer you an opportunity to redact certain portions of the documents?
Not the probable cause decision. The probable cause decision, in my opinion.
So there was a request to take the probable cause decision out?
Yeah, we made a strong objection. In fact, we had filed a motion in limine, which is part of our record. We felt that the sending these probable cause decision, which is the same situation that happened in the Lewis versus Chicago, it was highly prejudicial. It was detailed, incriminating type of information. It was accusatory in nature. And the jury, who doesn't understand that a probable cause is nothing but just one step in the process. The Phillips case was never decided.
Did you ask for any kind of limiting instruction from the district court?
We objected to the overall file, Your Honor.
Right, but you never asked the district court to make sure the jury understood the purpose for which it was to use this evidence?
We certainly, I don't recall making that specific request, but we filed a motion in limine, and then again we objected to that decision, and we believe that both the Manuel versus City of Chicago as well as the Lewis versus City of Chicago clearly indicate that a 403 rule allows both sides to have a balanced approach. And in this case, the probable cause decision was certainly extremely damaging to our client. And for that reason, we believe.
Yeah, but the whole point of having a limiting instruction, as I understood it, Blue didn't offer it to say discrimination there. In that case, therefore, I was discriminated against. I thought it was offered to put in context what her activities were and for the jury to get a total picture of how this thing arose. And my understanding of the record is that the plaintiff's counsel didn't even inject the racial issue into the trial until defense counsel cross-examined her about the fact that she was married to a black man.
But that really... With all due respect, I don't believe that in any way.
She was overly sensitive because her husband was black. Therefore, the file comes in, you know, to put it in context, to show that, you know, what she was up against and to show the company's reaction and that kind of thing, that it was done for context.
What I understand is the court allowed that file in order to establish motive. We believe that there was plenty of testimony, plenty of evidence from the testimony of the plaintiff, from arguments of counsel, that the probable cause decision was totally unnecessary. And if you look at the probable cause decision, it's so accusatory. The jury most likely developed this resentment about what the union supposedly did to Mr. Phillips, and the end result was certainly negative. And that is the basis of our appeal.
So was there any instruction given at final when the instructions went to the jury? I understand there was no instruction given when the file was actually admitted. Was there any instruction submitted
None.
At the conclusion as to how to use this file? Okay.
None.
All right.
Thank you.
You'd like to save a little bit for rebuttal, it's probably good. All right. Ms. Cannelli.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I represent the plaintiff appellee, Susan Blue, and we are here today to ask that the court either dismiss this appeal for lack of jurisdiction or affirm the trial court order denying the defendant's post-trial motions.
So are you contesting that we have jurisdiction over what I'm calling kind of effectively the Rule 60 motion, or are you just, because we would have a case before us if we can review as though it were Rule 60 motion, the February denial of the post-verdict, February 3, 2011 denials, or are you saying there's no jurisdiction, period?
I'm saying the order being appealed from asserts two bases.
Mm-hmm.
Affirm or reverse the court's judgment, affirm to deny judgment as a matter of law, or to grant a new trial, and that those are issues that should have could have and should have been raised by way of a direct appeal from the judgment. The defendants have not done that. Their appeal is untimely.
Their appeal is untimely, you're arguing, as to the underlying judgment.
Correct.
But there may be something in the February 3 order denying those late motions to the extent it's like a Rule 6. It's 60B6, even, you could say.
Was looking at one of the court's cases yesterday. I'm not cited in the brief, but it does point out the point that you had raised with Mr. Arellano just a few minutes ago, and that it's treated as a Rule 60B motion.
Right.
And there are absolutely no grounds that defendant has cited in its brief that would justify the grant of a Rule 60B motion.
Okay, fair enough. I think you can probably leave it at that if you want to. So what about the use of this Madison file in the trial? Was the jury told at all how to weigh that or for what purpose it was coming in?
I apologize. It's my recollection that the court did give some instruction to the jury when these documents were being admitted.
Wasn't there a real risk that the jury would assume that if IBEW had discriminated against one employee, it was more likely to have discriminated against this new?
I don't believe.
Wasn't there a real risk, she's saying, that the jury might think if IBEW was willing to discriminate against one employee, Mr. Phillips, that it might then also have either discriminated against or retaliated against another?
I don't believe.
Permissible propensity inference.
The evidence was clearly used and argued as a motive to retaliate against the plaintiff.
Blue's role in Phillips' discrimination complaint was uncontested at trial. I mean, what did that report add?
I didn't understand the question.
The report was uncontested at trial, the fact of discrimination and the allegation. So what did this add, adding this report?
What did the probable cause determination add to the report?
The documents from the file as a whole. You had, as Mr. Arellano has said, a fair amount of information about the Phillips situation already in the record. Why did you need to come in with this report that gives it this very official air in the probable cause determination, makes it look like something very official has happened?
To address that question, because the specific findings in the probable cause decision made it clear that Ms. Blue's testimony was important to the determination, they had cited her testimony as support that contradicted the employer's claim that Mr. Phillips had been referred to a higher list. And it wasn't a final decision finding discrimination. It is not unduly prejudicial, as Mr. Arellano is claiming. If you read through the entire decision, it gives both parties views and positions. That's how these probable cause decisions are written. They simply determine that there is an issue for hearing. There was no finding of discrimination, and that's quite clear in this decision.
So your point is that in order for the jury to evaluate the retaliation claim, they had to see the extent that she was involved or the extent of her testimony or what she said at the hearing. Is that your point?
Yes, it is. That they would be angry or more apt to retaliate, especially Mr. Harrelson, that the agency had found based on her evidence and her statement to them.
Probable cause, even though this was just one step in the process.
Right.
Now, you mentioned you thought there were some jury instructions.
I don't think it was a formal jury instruction at the end, but I'm pretty certain the judge said something to the jury when there were references to these documents, that this is to be considered only as you know, going to the motive to retaliate. The issue here is not whether or not the jury discriminated against Mr. Phillips. I said that in my closing statement. I made that point in talking about these documents.
Do you agree it makes a bigger, it makes a, and I appreciate you said it, but it makes a big difference if it's the judge that said it to the jury?
Correct.
In terms of how the evidence should be used.
Right. I do recall in the motions in limine that occurred pre-trial that I'm sure that Judge Conley offered and indicated that a curative instruction could be given with regard to these documents. And he did offer to have all of them redacted,
so
including the probable cause determination.
And that is part of the record?
Yes, it is.
Discussion?
Yes. So.
In other words, it's been transcribed.
And this was also a case where there were periodic flurries of retaliatory activity. The complaint comes in, she has a discussion, and then they take retaliatory action against her. She files her own complaint. There's some renewed retaliatory action. The probable cause is issued.
Eventually were wiped off her record by the new business manager?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then after the probable cause hearing, to finish your train of thought, there were more retaliatory actions?
There was a letter that Mr. Harrelson issued within a few days of the probable cause, admonishing her with regard to overtime, directing her to take overtime off of her time sheets, that she was not permitted to work overtime. She had always been permitted to do so before. And then, again, maybe 5 months later in February of the next year, we come to when the MEOC issues a hearing, a notice of hearing. And then, again, we have another flurry of retaliatory activity, four write-ups and two suspensions that happen within a few weeks' time. And so the theory of the case was that she engaged in these protected activities and that at those junctures the defendant retaliated or escalated its retaliation. And so it was important for that as well, for the jury to see the probable cause finding, which was not prejudicial. The defendants have it in their appendix at pages 9 through 12, and I would invite the court to read it to assess for itself whether the document is prejudicial. I don't believe it is. The defendants were allowed to present evidence countering this. They weren't limited in any way. And Mr. Hoffman did testify as to his understanding as to why Mr. Phillips was let go. They were allowed to present their evidence and their countervailing proof at this trial. Unless the court has some more questions, I'm not sure if I'm out of time or...
You don't need to use all of your time. So I think everybody is satisfied, so thank
you
very
thank
much.
You.
Anything further, Mr. Arellano?
Just briefly, thank you. Your Honor, just to reemphasize, this was truly an overkill. The record will show that the union stipulated that she had engaged in protected activity.
Are you familiar with the Old Chief case? I know this is in the criminal area and it's the United States, but in general, people are entitled to present their case as they wish. So you can't take the sting out completely with a stipulation.
And that's true. And I continue to go back to the probable cause decision, which is so similar to the Lewis decision, where they wanted to have a blow-by-blow account of something totally separate and different.
But what about her argument that each time there was some action, essentially that's her argument. The reason that it was needed was once that probable cause finding was made, there was a reaction by the union. And then when there was a hearing sometime later, there was a reaction. Now, I understand that's her point of view, and that's not your view of what the evidence is, but that's the context in which even that probable cause finding becomes relevant.
The context that the court used was to establish motive. Now, this was a case
The motive for retaliation was the fact that she testified at the probable cause.
And that she was really deeply involved.
And that she had more of a role. She wasn't just like a bookkeeper that filled out a document. That it was her
name was right there.
Her word is all over the report.
There was plenty of evidence that she had written a questionnaire, she had responded to questions to the MEOC, there was stipulation, there was testimony, but there was also significant testimony that she went toe-to-toe with her boss. She wanted to play politics, she was disciplined for many other reasons which were not discriminatory.
But they heard all that.
Judge Rovner said, but they heard all that.
That's true. And I'm just simply stating again that with the amount of information that they had available, these particular provocos was an overkill and a violation of 403. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement.